Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me a bit later will be Candace LaPage as we tackle another week, another review, and, maybe we're getting a bit closer to going back to the movie theater. Who knows? I mean, we're going to tackle that in the news in a minute, but, things are changing rapidly here. We're still recording from home, and we will likely be for the foreseeable future because things on campus are maybe not as fluid as out in the greater community. But you know what? Maybe seeing movies on the big screen is something to look forward to. The last time I think we did that was for the Way Back. Way back in March. I'll have to check our show notes, but I'm pretty sure that was the last episode we did based on a movie on the big screen. Anyway, this is not that week. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new romantic comedy, Almost Love, which you can now stream on Netflix. And as I indicated for the first half of the show this week, we're going to cover some traditional ground and look at some movie news. So I've made a top 10 list of recent movie news stories. Starting with the status of theaters here in Canada, or at least the big chain theaters. A lot of independent theaters are sort of under their own initiative to decide when they're going to open. For example, the Apollo Cinema, which is a rep theater in Kitchener, is currently open and screening films. The biggest cinema chain in the country, Cineplex, they now have 95 locations reopened across Canada, and they have an eye on opening 137 by the end of this week. That is almost their entire complement of theaters. I believe Cineplex has something in the neighborhood of 170 theaters across Canada, so that puts them pretty close to being fully reopened. Of course, fully reopened is relative because there are only so many seats available in each theater. For instance, here in Ontario, it's 50 per screen, a maximum of 50 seats per screen. So that's that, as they say. Every little bit helps, though, I imagine, is probably the argument from a lot of businesses these days. Looking to the south of the border, though, AMC Theaters, which, as you may recall, has been sort of on the brink of collapse through the entire COVID crisis. They say all of their international screens will be open the next 2 to 3 weeks, and they expect that 2/3 of their U.S. theaters will be open by the end of the month. That's this month, although I think that is probably still really optimistic, given that the United States has just passed 5 million cases of COVID-19 this past weekend, and it is slowing down in certain hotspots. That's by no means a certainty, and if things get going too rapidly again, who knows where we could be end up, in just 3 weeks. So along similar lines, number 9, Jurassic Park. Jurassic Park has made over $1 million so far for 2020, which makes it one of the highest grossing films of 2020, or at the very least of the summer of 2020. A few films, including The Rental, which is an IFC film, and The Goonies, which is the 1985 Richard Donner movie, have also all made over $1 million. The Wrecked is another movie that's made over $1 million. Jurassic Park, to having made $1 million this year, is because a lot of theaters that have been able to reopen, drive-ins as well, showing Jurassic Park as kind of programming. So it's kind of interesting when you factor that in. You also factor in Empire Strikes Back has made $611,000. I mean, it's kind of funny typical years, the summer box office, you're a success if you make $100 million in your first weekend. But now we're celebrating if a movie makes $1 million in a weekend, even if it was a movie that came out over 25 years ago, nearly 30 years ago. So, I mean, that goes to show you just how maybe desperate we are to scrape for good news when it comes to box office returns. Number eight, you know, movies are going to get going again. And then we get this rumor out of Poland about a bridge being destroyed. This 111-year-old bridge in a town in Poland that is apparently being eyed to be destroyed in a brilliant stunt effects sequence for Mission Impossible 7, which they're trying to get restarted again. It was in the middle of shooting when COVID hit and production shut down, as it did in all movies and TV shows. Christopher McQuarrie had to, like, issue a letter explaining the situation. It turns out they weren't going to destroy the whole bridge. This is a bridge that has been around for 111 years, but it was partially destroyed in the German retreat in the Second World War, and the part of it that was rebuilt after that has basically been derelict. It's basically been allowed to become kind of a public hazard, so it's not being used right now. So basically, the movie is going to blow up the derelict section and then rebuild it, basically saving the bridge. And it's gotten out of hand. So why did it get out of hand? Well, Christopher McQuarrie says that it was basically a local vendor who was mad that they didn't have a part to play in the making of the movie that started spreading this rumor that the Mission Impossible 7 production was going to blow up this bridge, part and parcel in its entirety, historical, cultural, local love of the bridge, be damned. And Christopher McQuarrie has issued a statement to assure the people in Poland, but also people concerned about conserving natural heritage, that he is not blowing up bridges willy-nilly. So that's complicated. Number seven, the RoboCop statue in Detroit is about to become a reality. This has been in the works for almost 10 years. Basically, you know, there's the Rocky statue in Philadelphia on the steps of the Philadelphia Public Library, which has been a big tourist attraction for years and years. Detroit wants to do the same thing for RoboCop, RoboCop being a notable folk hero from Detroit. Famously, the Paul Verhoeven movie is set in Detroit. A lot of people didn't like the... I mean, one of the reasons it's taken so long is, I mean, it's a crowdfunded effort, first of all. Second of all, it's a huge statue. It's 11 feet tall and about half a ton. Bronze, by the way. It's a bronze statue. But there's been a lot of controversy about it because, you know, the Detroit in RoboCop is not a nice Detroit, shall we say. It's not the kind of Detroit you want to celebrate in the tourist brochures. And of course, after the economic collapse in 2008, Detroit was hit so hard. Like, basically half the city's population moved out of the city. Buildings were derelict, entire neighborhoods were falling apart. And Detroit has sort of bounced back since and sort of has become a sort of model of sort of post-industrial recovery now. So, you know, they've been a bit hedgy about RoboCop and his violent response to crime waves in Detroit in the not-too-distant future, which I think that timing has now passed. I can't remember the year RoboCop takes place in, but I'm pretty sure we're past it now. I mean, we're even past the year that Blade Runner took place in, so what are you going to do? Number six, Star Trek. Now, it's a pretty good time for Star Trek on TV. You have Star Trek Discovery coming back this fall. You have Star Trek Picard just finished up its first season. You have Star Trek Lower Decks, which is an animated version of Star Trek, now on Crave. But the movies, there's just been no movement on since 2016 when Star Trek Beyond came out. It didn't do very well at the box office, even though it was celebrating Star Trek's 50th anniversary. The new head of film at Paramount Pictures, which owns Star Trek, Emma Watts, has basically put all Star Trek movie projects on hold. Not the TV projects, the movie projects. And this includes what would basically be the continuation of the last three movies, the so-called Kelvin timeline, with TV director S.J. Clarkson. There's, of course, a movie being supervised by Noah Hawley, the creator of the TV show Fargo. He was doing a kind of separate story, supposedly having to do with a virus wiping out the universe. Obviously, that's probably not a sensitive kind of science fiction topic, given the times. And then, of course, there was famously the Quentin Tarantino R-rated Star Trek, which... one of the websites got some detail about. Apparently, it's like got a 1930s gangster film flavor, which suggests that it takes place on the planet from the original series episode "A Piece of the Action," where it's basically this alien society that found a book that was left behind by a previous Starfleet expedition that outlined the gangs of the Prohibition era Chicago and then modeled their whole society on it. And Captain Kirk and Spock and McCoy end up on this planet having to, you know, sort everybody out. That could have been cool. I don't know if it'll happen. But, you know, it seemed like the ideal end for a Quentin Tarantino Star Trek movie. To have it be on the 1930s gangster world. But we may never know. Speaking of movies, that could be coming soon to a theater near you, Captain Marvel 2, of course, this is the sequel to the 2019 hit Captain Marvel, starring Brie Larson as the cosmic superhero. Nia DaCosta, who is the woman behind the Candyman reboot, which was, or is being produced by, Jordan Peele. It is still scheduled to come out in October. We will have to wait and see, but apparently, based on the positive reaction so far to that movie, Nia DaCosta has been offered the director slot for Captain Marvel 2. This would not make her the first woman to direct a Marvel movie. It would, however, make her the first black woman to direct a Marvel movie. And an interesting pick at that. If it seems weird that after one horror movie that Nia DaCosta would get hired, I mean, this kind of follows a trend where you have a director who makes a really hot indie or low-budget movie, and they get called up to make one of these big summer tent poles. It happened to Colin Trevorrow, to think of one example. Taika Waititi, to think of another example. So, it's well within that role, and it'll be interesting to see if Nia DaCosta gets the job and what she's going to do with Captain Marvel, because there was a lot of promise in that first movie. Number four is the Schumacher Cut. What is this, the Schumacher Cut? Well, of course, people know about the Snyder Cut, which is the Justice League edited version by Zack Snyder. A lot of people have been submitting rumors about the Schumacher Cut, which be the Joel Schumacher original assembly cut of Batman Forever. Schumacher's gotten a lot of beef for the films. The Batman films he made, because of their silliness, because of their campiness, because of the nipples on the Batsuit and all that. But there was a famously darker cut of Batman Forever that dealt a lot with the inner psychology of Bruce Wayne, and, you know, the things he's kind of haunted by. And so it was almost three hours long, and it was cut down. I think the original film is just over 2 hours long. So people think, could there be a Schumacher cut coming? Val Kilmer will be at DC Fandom event. I think it's called the DC Fandom event. And so a lot of people are thinking, why else would Val Kilmer be here? He's kind of been semi-retired from acting because he's been dealing with throat cancer. But, you know, why else would you truck him out if not to announce the Schumacher cut? I mean, it is also the 25th anniversary of Batman Forever this year, I think. 25. So it could be just a tribute to him and his one time in the Batsuit, but we don't know. Now, 3, 2, and 1 are kind of all connected, so I'm going to take them all together. Disney posted its first quarterly loss in 20 years. It lost $4.72 billion in the last quarter. That's a fall of 42%. The last time Disney lost or had a quarterly loss was in 2001, when it only lost $567 million. That might be the reason why we now have news that Mulan, the big budget remake of the Disney animated film will be premiering on Disney Plus on September 4th. So first of all, you have to subscribe to Disney Plus, which I believe is $6.99 a month, but then this is going to be an additional $29.99 a month to view Mulan, $29.99. For places that have that don't have Disney Plus, the movie will open in theaters. I'm not sure how many places that is. I'm also not sure if maybe there'll be some sort of small release in, you know, we all have Disney Plus here in Canada, but could it be possible that it could be at our movie theaters? I'm not sure about that. But a lot of people are seeing this as maybe the first sign Disney's throwing in the towel on perhaps getting a wide open release for Mulan, just to put it on their own platform and to have the additional ticket price for it. In the meantime, Tenet will be opening internationally on August 28th, and it will be opening in select theaters in the U.S. on September 3rd. I'm not sure if Canada will be part of the international release, but it will likely come out on that Labor Day weekend here in Canada. It's interesting to note that in the Tenet case, it has Christopher Nolan being very, very adamant about the big screen release, that, you know, he's going to be the impediment to this coming out on streaming in any way, shape, or form before it is out in the movie theater. So I would not expect a video on demand option for Tenet, and that's going to be the real test. The real test is on September the 3rd when Tenet comes out. Will that drive people back to the movie theater? We will have to wait and see, of course. And we'll have to wait and see what we think of this week's movie, which is Almost Love. And to warm you up, here's some Almost Lovelies here on end credits. Here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Seen the details today? Markram looks like the truest form of a Kennedy.
Yeah.
One minute we're all working at TV2, the next minute he's famous.
I am obsessed with your website.
Oh, thank you.
Can I grab you for a quick shot?
Oh, no, just Markram.
Just get married.
I'm not taking his money, Elizabeth.
It's not taking money when you're married. It's called sharing.
Two men together is trick.
You're in a partnership, for God's sake.
Look, these past 3 weeks, getting to know you have been amazing, and it's something that
You're making me nervous.
I'm homeless.
I'm sorry, what now?
Haley, he's a child.
He just needs help with his homework.
You're so smart.
You are moving into some very serious territory right now.
I can't stop thinking about you.
You have to stop.
It hurts.
I have a crush.
I can't go on.
Oh, no, that's not going to work. It's electric.
It doesn't even work.
Oh.
And that was a clip from Almost Love. It is the new film from writer-director Mike Doyle, and it stars Scott Evans, Augustus Prue, Michelle Buteau, Colin Donnell, Zoe Chow, Kate Walsh, and Patricia Clarkson. So I am now being joined on the line by Candice LaPage, fresh from vacation. This should be very good on Candice's end, given that she's had a lot of time to rest in and recreate and have some really thoughtful ideas about our review this week. How are you, Candice?
Great. I feel a little pressure, you know. What I do, when I'm vacationing is try not to think about things. So, I don't know. Maybe that makes more space for when it comes time to think.
I do want to note some fun trivia for all the Law & Order fans. The writer and director, Mike Doyle, was on Law & Order SVU for years as one of the frequently appearing CSI people that they work with. He was O'Halloran, the forensic tech, for years.
I believe
he was killed off at some point, though.
Well, you know, with, 27 years or something of the series, there's probably going to be a few characters die. I mean, we know cops don't retire in New York City.
No, they announce their retirement and then are killed 3 days before.
That's right. Yes. Right after saying, I'm too old for this. Bleep.
Oh, and no, it's usually right after they talk about their retirement plans with their partner. They're going to go sailing, they're going to go on a nice trip with their wife.
Yeah, treat their wife the way they haven't treated them for the last 30 years. Yeah, because
they're so busy being a cop, it's going to be so great. And then...
I'm pretty sure we're writing a movie or a television show right now.
I have a feeling it'd be better than Almost Love.
Well, I don't know if it'll be better, but it will definitely be the same as everything else, which is kind of a little bit like what this movie is. It doesn't make it bad. Like, you know, it just makes it this. I will say that Almost Love is a fine diversion if you just want to put something on.
Well, it is something.
Yeah. I have a few notes of things I did like, so it's not going to be a total hate fest. But there were a few problems.
Why don't we start by having you explain the of all the things you can stream on Netflix, what made Almost Love stick out for you?
Well, I will be 100% honest and say what made it stick out, as listeners probably know, is that it's totally outside of my sort of genre of film. It's not what I normally choose. So I was away on vacation. I arrived home late Friday afternoon, so had only a short time to sort of scroll through the newish releases and decide on some things. And I will admit that, I made a list of a couple of interesting looking sort of horror films and one like a comedy horror. I also had a little list of some like high school, like teen melodrama. Those are my, two genres, obviously. And then there was this adult melodrama or adult rom-com. I think we call them rom-coms when they're with adults and melodramas when they're with teens. But, you know, I was like, oh, adults. Okay, we could try that. And an ensemble cast sometimes works really well. I do think sometimes, and I think that's part of the thing with this film is that ensembles sometimes is not much story, but like seven different little ones, which I think is something that this film had a bit of a problem with, where there wasn't really enough for a whole movie, and then there was a number of people, so they had to keep adding little things. But and I will also admit that the other reason I chose it was because, and interesting that you say the director was on SVU for a really long time. So one of the images that I had for the sort of cover art was of two of the characters, Cammy and Haley, when they were walking, over the High Line, which is, a linear park, as they call it. but in SVU, of course, and in original Law & Order, back in the 80s and 90s, was typically where they found bodies. So it's interesting that was the place. But I saw the photo and I was like, oh, and it was a part of the High Line that sort of looks over the meatpacking district as opposed to, part that looks a little bit further up, more towards Greenwich, not quite Greenwich Village, but that direction. So I was like, oh, this looks like it's going to be a movie that's kind of made by people from New York who want to sort of show the city. And I like that. I'm cool with a film where the city is part of the character. So I thought, sure, great. let's do this. And so then we ended up with an ensemble film about, what, 5, 6 people, some single, some in relationships, wandering around New York, in some of the more expensive parts of New York. And I really only know what 2 of them, well, I guess 3 of them did for work. And I'm not really sure that their work would afford them the lifestyle they were living.
Yeah, it's Friends all over again. it's interesting you should say that you don't think, or you didn't think there was enough story. Because I think there was a lot of story that, for some reason, didn't end up in the film. Because there's a subplot about Kate Walsh and her husband, who have been married for 15 years, but they separate for much of the film, and I don't think it's ever really explained why, or, you know, why it went from, like, 0 to separation, which is, it's made equally bizarre, because the thing ends in their, like, recommitment, and it's like, we skipped over the entire plot of what's going on with this couple, we meet them, they go through some kind of problem that is never identified, but then the problem is resolved. And it's like, okay, I like Kate Walsh a lot, but, give her something to do. And then there was another scene where the main couple, which is a gay couple, Adam and Marklin, they're in, like, some kind of couples therapy. And I remember, like, the scene transition, it, like, smash cuts to them in therapy, and the therapist is like, wrapping up and saying, well, we've done a lot of good work today, we had a really good breakthrough today, and it's like, well, what was the breakthrough?
Yeah, we don't even know what they've been talking about. They're both clearly, like, upset and silent, and then they come out and, you know, seem to be happy as, you know, pigs in crap, as they say, and, you know, racing their bikes home, and I'm like, so are they just, like, is this a bet that they're just like, hey, can we break a marriage counselor? I don't really understand. It is funny, though. I sort of agree with you that there were too many stories and not enough of any one story. And primarily the film really centered around Adam and Marklin, which was fine. And I liked their story. And I actually really like the idea of a rom-com being about an established couple sort of recommitting a little bit or, you know, moving to the next phase rather than, you know, brand new love, which is, we've been told that story a million times. But I think there was a lot of their story, which was nice, but we could also see that each of them had a lot of backstory that could have been filled in a lot. You know, Marklin's character has this ex who has a terminal disease that he's caring for, which I think is a really interesting storyline that was just sort of all it served was, this is just sort of one of the things he's keeping from Adam. And then Adam, you know, has a father, grew up with in an alcoholic household, and it's the same thing. It's just sort of thrown there, and I'm like, you know what? This could help explain a lot of the reasons why, you know, Adam is such a unmotivated loser, sort of.
No, it's and the dad's played by John Doman, who's a really great character actor who people will recognize him when he appears, even if they don't know his name. Yeah, the whole thing with that character, too, the thing that I really kind of enjoyed about it, it's such a small scene, but they're in this restaurant where they're having lunch or something, but he's, like, talking to the waiter about, hey, here's my son, he's going to be a great artist, and you know, he's this really kind of upbeat and positive dad, and he asks about Adam's relationship with Marklin and how's it going, so he clearly doesn't have an issue with his son's sexuality or anything like that, and it seems like, wow, this seems like a really positive life-affirming relationship between a father and a son, and then you see the father excuses himself to use the washroom, and he stops at the bar to have a drink, even though he's supposed to be on the wagon. And you're just like, where has this movie been for the last 60 minutes?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, primarily, like I said, it focuses on those two characters and their relationship. That's really sort of the main driver of all of the plot. And then they have all their friends. And where I think, you know, it falls into the problem of an ensemble is where it's like, okay, each of the friends has to have their own side thing going on. And so I agree with you. Like, I really liked Kate Walsh. I'd like to know more about why Kate Walsh, her character, what is her name? I can't remember. But
Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, thank you. So I'd like to know, one, why her and Adam are such good friends. Like, how did they meet? They clearly have an age difference. And because the thing, that's the other thing that sort of confused me about this film. And I think part of it is because I'm so used to watching teen melodramas where 20-year-olds are playing teens. So I was watching this going, how old are these people supposed to be? Is this like their late 20s transition to 30s? But I think it's actually supposed to be their late 30s transition to 40s, because the Adam character at one point, you know, reflects on his own behavior and says, you know, this was fine for a while, but it's not a way to live in my 40s. And I was like, oh, except of course, Kate Walsh is clearly, you know, 15 to 20 years older than all of these other actors.
I think Kate Walsh is in her 50s, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And I agree, too, that I did really like the story. You know, we could have watched that story also of her and Damon, I think is her husband's name, or, you know, partner, and then they decide to get married, whatever the case. Because it sort of starts, too, with him lamenting the fact, you know, and finally accepting the fact that he's not going to have kids. He wanted to he always thought he wanted to have kids. She never wanted to have kids. They've been in this relationship for a long time, and he's finally accepted, okay, we're not having kids. And then suddenly she's, and I don't even know if they've broken up, because when she's talking to Adam about how he's having an affair, Adam is like, but you don't know that. It's just text. And she's like, oh, it's the same thing. It doesn't matter. So yeah. we still don't even know what's going on, especially because he, you know, again, another little side thing where him and Marklin were painting this room, which was how they were talking about, oh, I thought it was going to be a nursery. Now we're going to rent it to an office worker or something. So maybe he was just texting this person who's going to rent a room in their house. I don't know. But
yes, it's not exactly clear.
Yeah. So, I feel like this was a film made with a bunch of sort of New York actors who all sort of know each other. You know, it almost kind of felt like a bit of a workshop. Like, we've all got characters. Mm. You know, we've workshopped these characters. Let's have them all be friends. And I think the Cammy character at one point says something about how, you know, we were just all, you know, working at TGI Fridays, and now Marklin's a big lifestyle blogger, which it took me a while to really decide what it was he did for a living. I was like, is he a YouTuber? No, he's taking photos. Is he an Instagram influencer? No, he wrote something. He must be a blogger. Okay. And by the way, people don't make money blogging anymore. I don't know. Obviously, when they wrote this film, they were writing it for 15 years ago, because you don't make money blogging. You make money YouTube. Video. It's all about video, baby.
Yeah, I thought he was an influencer, too, because it shows him on his site a couple times, and it looks vaguely Instagram-y. Like, they say they created a, like, somebody in the production design said, like, make an Instagram, but not Instagram. And about that, too, I'm finding that, like, a social media influencer is, like, the new movie job where the character needs a job where they have an enormous amount of free time, but they are still, like, doing something cool and cutting edge.
Because we know magazines aren't a thing anymore. So none of them are magazine writers.
Right. This is it, right? Because I was, of course, it's in New York City. So, of course, I'm thinking about Sex and the City. And Carrie Bradshaw writes one weekly column, but seems to have an enormous amount of, available income to, you know, go to restaurants and cafes and shoe shopping all day, which I don't think was ever really the case. But, you know, now it's influencing and being an influencer. And that sounds like, and that's another bizarre thing is like he's, Markland seems like very famous for this, whatever this job is he's doing.
Yeah. Like the surgeon at the hospital, his couples therapist, like every, you know, I can understand sort of being stopped on the street by, you know, the first time we see it happen, it's a younger sort of gay rights activist who's, you know, trying to get petitions. I'm like, okay, that I get that. Like, that's a clear thing. But then increasingly higher and higher sort of caliber of people. And apparently it's supposed to be like a men's fashion sort of thing. So no offense to marriage counselors and you know, doctors at the hospital, but I don't see either of them as particularly fashionable careers. So I don't know why they're following a fashion blog by a man who's in his questionable age, 27 to 35.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to just kind of put, it's one of these situations where you're just like, okay, this is a thing in the movie. Okay, well, we'll just leave it. And the other thing too, the Adam character is a painter, but he's like a ghost painter, which I didn't know was a thing. But he paints things. And then this, quote unquote artist signs her name to it and it's put up in a gallery. It's her show, even though it's all his artwork. Which I would love a movie that just focused on that, especially if it got more Patricia Clarkson as the fake artist.
Yeah, what a delight to suddenly see her. I was like, oh, that was interesting. Now, so that job is a thing, but not quite in the way that they were portraying it. But certainly, like a lot of artists will hire sort of students, grad students, that sort of thing, who help them prepare canvases, right? Like paint the canvas, get it ready, that sort of thing. And then also I think that sort of style of, you know, having just like a workmanship sort of journeyman artist, whatever, to help with a bigger scale projects, you know, murals and things like that, because those you have to kind of get done in quick fashion, but the artist has already done the work, you know, like here's what it's going to look like. Okay, now we've got to make it up here and we got to do it fast. But yeah, this seemed a little over the top. And maybe that's part of, you know, again, that could have been the whole story because, you know, I think she's taking advantage of a thing that a lot of artists do, but eventually just sort of, well, I'll just stop doing the work entirely and let you do all the work, which is a whole other thing. That's, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I do understand that fundamentally that, you know, for big installations and things, artists have assistants who put things together and prepare things. But the whole idea of having someone make the art and then putting your name on it, I don't know. But, you know, it to go back to something you said earlier about a bunch of actors getting together and, you know, making a thing. There are times like that where I wondered about that, if how much of this was maybe improvisational, because that scene at the art gallery where they're talking to Patricia Clarkson as the air quote artist, and this one woman's asking her, like, what is your inspiration for this piece? And she's just like making it up out of whole cloth. And I was watching that scene. I'm wondering, it's like, was this scripted or is this Patricia Clarkson just riffing and coming up with stuff on the fly? And because there are a lot of scenes like that too, that I found in the movie.
Yeah. Well, it's like they, you know, she was basically playing herself in a way, right? It's like, okay, we'll have Patricia Clarkson show up for one day of shooting. We won't really tell her what the movie's about or even like who the other actors are, just that she's an artist and okay, go. So it's almost like, you know, she's portraying her own sort of confusion. It's like, oh, well, I'm here acting in this film that's about these things. But it was very nice. Like, yeah, it was quite nice to see her. It was sort of fun. You know, yeah, a movie with Patricia Clarkson and Kate Walsh, you know, in Manhattan, that could be an interesting film too.
Yeah, no, and because they were also playing off each other in that scene too, where Kate Walsh is standing up for Adam and by trying to like passive aggressively expose Patricia Clarkson as a fraud. You know, and it's interesting too, because last weekend I watched all three Maze Runner movies, which Patricia Clarkson is in, and you know what? She had more to do in Almost Love than in those movies.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, think about that. Actually, it turned out I really enjoyed the Maze Runner movies, but that's neither here nor there. I do like that we have these like kind of familiar faces pop up too, but I do also like, I thought I recognized Augustus Pugh, who plays Marklin from something. I don't know. I looked at his IMDb and nothing really jumped out at me. But, you know, there are a lot of really great actors in this. Zoe Chow, who plays Haley, who's one of the friends, I thought was pretty... Like, her scenes are kind of, like, the most... I want to say hyper, in terms of, like, hyper-reality. And not that she is being hyper in them, but her scenes, because her storyline involves, like... A student she has who is crushing on her and maybe wants to have a romantic relationship with her, and maybe she's thinking about having a romantic relationship with him. And there's kind of some back and forth there, but it was like really hyper. It was really inflated in terms of its realism too. So, I mean, I don't know if that's how they were playing it, but there was something weirdly charming in her performance. And then her friend, Michelle... Buttow, who plays Cammy, I liked a lot too. She had a nice level of sardonic that I enjoyed.
Yeah, I will agree with you that I think Michelle, I'm not sure how to say the last name either. I'd say Buteau, but yes, Cammy, I think was for sure, to me, she was sort of the standout of all the actors. I think she was the most fun to watch, and I really liked her performance. I do think Augustus Pugh, who played Marklin, was also really good, and I think he had a lot to do, which was nice, and he did it really well. He really had to show a sort of a wide variety of things, you know, particularly when we got into some of the parts about him being, you know, not the caregiver, but the essential like power of attorney, medical power of attorney for his ex. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you your opinion on the the Haley storyline, because I thought it was so strange. There were a lot of times to me that she seemed like two completely different characters, like the character that she was as the tutor, you know, to this kid. Whose name is Scott James? Who has two first names for a name? I could not get over it. And she kept saying it over and over again.
That was super confusing. Like, is his name Scott, first name, last name James? And it just kind of, like, flows together? Or is he, like, Scott James, I don't know, Reynolds or something? Where
it's
hyphenated?
It's Scott James is his first name and something else is his last name. But yeah, like... You know, it opens with her, and of course we'll have to talk about the Cammy storyline because I have some things to say about that. But it opens with her, you know, on this walk with her friend Cammy, and she seems like the kind of bold, brash friend who's, you know, telling everybody how things are. And then we see her actually doing her work, and I'm like, did her voice get higher pitched? And she sounds so hesitant. Everything is. You know, and I guess, sure, like, she's, you know, I think we're to believe that she's being paid a lot of money by probably Upper East Side parents to get their really not very bright son, all the things that Upper East Side parents think their kids should have just because of their money. So, mm-hmm. you know, I get that she would maybe be really a little more deferential, but it just, every time she was with him, I was like, who is this person? This is not a character who we've already been introduced to. This is a completely different person. And on top of that, I just, that whole storyline really just bothered me a lot, not only because she was so different, but also just, I'm not really a fan of the, like, teacher-student sort of thing. And then on top of that, you know, this movie's a lot about relationships. And, you know, she, like I said, seems kind of, maybe not smart, but sort of brash and telling other people about their relationships. And then she falls into this sort of relationship because she just needs codependency and needs to be needed. It just did not seem right at all. And I'm sure there are much better persons to be codependent with. There are certainly lots of other people who could need her who aren't a 17-year-old boy trying to get into Columbia. Or maybe it was Brown. I don't remember.
It was Brown. Well, Ivy League. I mean, that adds to the confusion with the character. Now that we're kind of like talking it out, because, you know, in the process of watching it, kind of go with where the story is taking you. But yeah, it just seemed weird. The way she would say, like, Scott James, and it was like somebody was doing a high school production of this movie, and or at least of those scenes. And then there's a scene later on where they're like airing kind of like their drama, and then she blurts out that she had sex with the kid, Scott James, who's 17, so I mean, on the brink of adulthood, whatever. But at the same time, she says this and everyone's like, wait, what did she do? And she's like, oh, I'm just trying to create drama in my life since everyone else is having drama.
Yeah, I just wanted to have a story.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Which seems to be a theme in this movie, where we have stories that go unreported and stories that are happening off screen by and large, and only kind of appear when John Doman has a free day. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so then there's the Cammy storyline. Which mm-hmm. pretty much right from the get-go, I was just like, I'm pretty sure this is the only character I can identify with in this film. So Cammy is not that I can identify with Cammy, but the person she's dating, you know, she's been dating this person for a couple of weeks, and presumably, you know, they met online. That's the way people, you know, people make dates now on Tinder and things like that.
She says they met on Tinder, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, he admits to her after 3 weeks of going out, and I don't know when the right time to say this sort of thing would happen anyways, but that basically he's living in a shelter because he's homeless. And I'm like, well, yeah, like, how does anybody live in Manhattan? Like, you either live in a shelter or you live in a closet in a shared space with 10 other people, which is basically living in a shelter. Like... And then, of course, her reaction is, but you have such nice shoes. I'm like, holy, I don't, what? People can be between homes or couch surfing and still, like, have hygiene and style and, like, a life. It was just such a weird thing. But, yeah, his, you know, the homeless character, which basically that's what he was to all of her friends. He's just the homeless person. I'm like, you know, I mean, not only that, you know, we find out that he was in a situation, he was living with someone, she was taking care of all the bills. Who knows why he wasn't able to contribute? You know, maybe he was between jobs or who knows what. They broke up. He tried couch surfing and wasn't able to find anything. Okay. This happens. I mean, right in the movie, one of the main characters, Adam, is basically living this person's entire existence, you know, like right before the breakup, right? Adam is basically living with his boyfriend, Marklin, who is providing everything financially because he's making loads of money writing a blog and taking photos. So, you know, and of course, on top of that, you know, he's even one step closer because it seems like towards the end, he's basically deciding he's going to stop doing his job, which is paying him, so that he can make his own art. Like, I hope he's actually going to keep the paying job while also doing his own art, you know, and maybe like, maybe that's what happened to this guy, the homeless guy. You know, he was taking a chance on trying to do something. It didn't work out. And then there's no way up in Manhattan or in a lot of other places. But God, in like, how does anybody afford to live there? Of course, he's sort of couch surfing or having to stay in a shelter. And it was just, yeah.
Yeah, I thought more of was going to come of that story element, and I mean that could be said for so much of this movie, but in the end Cammy runs into him again. He's an Uber driver and he's like, look, I solved my problems, I got a job and I rented an apartment. It's like, okay, well,
that's all it takes just become an Uber driver. And not only that, I don't know how he's getting paid being an Uber driver, because he basically parked on her street for 3 weeks, he said, waiting for her to call an Uber, so he wasn't doing any other gigs.
Yeah.
Like, people don't know how people make money.
Well, I mean, that's kind of all over this movie. Yeah, that I did find problematic for those reasons. Because, you know, there are, like, little things in this that, you know, could speak to millennial angst. You know, the idea of having trouble finding places to live and couch surfing and you know, still trying to be sociable. You know, both Adam and Haley have jobs where they are essentially subservient to rich people, you know, doing all this labor, whether it's like creating paintings that you can't put your name on or getting deeply ignorant young people into colleges they should not be able to get into. Or, you know, Marklin, the selling the facade of the, you know, the hip, stylistic, you know, young person and all that. It just, there could have been some sort of commentary on all that. I feel like the movie is circling that. But at the end of the day, it is ultimately just a thing about, you know, cool people hanging out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, now that we've said so many negative things, I will just sort of come back to, I do still like I said earlier, the idea of a rom-com, you know, between a couple who are sort of 5 years in figuring out, like, what's the next step? Where, you know, is this a future together? Is it a permanent thing? Do we, you know, how do we decide what the next step is? You know, I think if you take away, you know, some of that sort of class stuff, which I think is more based on a person who's worked in movies and TV for a really long time, so who has a comfortable lifestyle, not really, like, that's the lifestyle he understands, so that's the lifestyle he's going to write about. So if you take sort of some of that stuff away and just sort of go back to the root of, you know, this sort of story between two people trying to figure out what's next, and then also having the sort of looking at their friends who are 15 years in, who are at the next stage of, okay, what's next. And, you know, I think it's okay. I like the idea of people sort of realizing that relationships take time and commitment and work. And just because it was easy for the first 3 years and you were just sort of hanging out and doing whatever, eventually there comes a time where you have to decide, are we just hanging out forever or are we actually doing something? And so it was nice to see, you know, that story. And like I said, there were some really good performances, particularly Michelle Buteau and Augustus Prue. And everybody else was good. Like, there were no bad performances. So, And then the other thing I would say is that, of course, this is this writer-director, what's it, Mike Doyle. This is his first feature-length film. So, mm-hmm. you know, he's got places to go.
Yes. Nobody's first film is perfect. I speak from experience. But I would agree. I liked the blueprints. They brought out the blueprints. They told me what they were going to do, and I liked what I saw. But when I went into the finished building, I couldn't help but notice that a lot of corners were cut, and I will leave that metaphor there.
Yeah. They filled in story that didn't need to be filled in, while they could have actually filled in the main story instead.
Yes, that is all fair. So, Candace, if people want to send you recommendations for better movies, yeesh, I'm kidding. how can people find you on the internet?
Yes, I'm available all over the internet at CINN48, that's CINN48.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday at Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can find us on social media, on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And in the meantime, I will be back here on CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at NMA Donaldson, or you can go to my News and Politics site, Guelph Politico at guelphpolitico.ca. Or you can read my horror movie reviews and things over at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. Stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. We'll be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then. Mm-hmm.